Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail.
Bring it back a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Calm. Public radio voice.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail.
No, that's too bedroomy.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Fireside chat.
Hello, everybody.
There you go. You nailed it.
Welcome back to We've Got Mail. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a film critic for The Wrap and Bloody Disgusting, and everybody calls me Bibbs.
See, you got romantic again. I feel like you got some champagne.
I'm just a romantic person.
I suppose so.
Yeah. I'm a lover, not a podcaster.
Actually, you are a podcaster, and you're a lover, too. You can be both. Por que no los dos? My name is Whitney Seibold. I'm the other guy. I write film reviews for IGN occasionally, and other places occasionally as well. And this is the podcast where we interact with you, our dear listeners, who write in your letters, letters@criticallyacclaimed.net, and we engage with you. We answer your letters, we address your questions, we address your concerns, we accept your corrections.
Yes, and your flat-out criticism, of which we actually get a fair amount, which I think is only fair since we ourselves are critics. This is your podcast. You get to decide what we talk about, and we're open books, so feel free to ask us questions, ask us for recommendations, challenge our critical views, whatever you'd like. And if you want to email us, letters@criticallyacclaimed.net is the email address. And I think that's about it. Most recently on the Critically Acclaimed Network, we had an episode of Critically Acclaimed where we presented our picks for the best films of the decade. Both Whitney and I had a top 10. I don't know if we're going to have any emails about this yet since that was a really long episode, but we want to encourage everybody, you know, for a while at least, to send us your top 10 films of the decade. We really don't have time to get into like really long discussions of every single movie, so we're looking pretty much just for a list of titles, maybe a couple of words about each. But we really would love to hear from all of you and figure out like what films resonated with all of our listeners as well as us. So feel free to send those in if you haven't already. And I guess now I yield the floor. Whitney, who's our first letter?
We asked you to send in your top 10 lists, and boy, howdy did people react.
Already? Already. No, okay, great.
So our first letter is from Pierre. Hello, Pierre.
Okay, one second, Pierre. Luke is on the coffee table.
Pierre just gave us a straight list. No sentences, no descriptions.
Right. Of
his top 20 films of the decade.
Fair enough.
If it's just a list, I think 20 is
fine. I think that's okay. We want to encourage people to do a top 10 because it requires you to be choosy.
He listed them 1 to 20. Should I count down? Should I do them 20 to 1?
I
think that's fair.
Yeah, your call.
All right, so number 20, The Fitz.
I remember when that came out. I never got around to that.
Number 19, The Endless.
Okay.
Number 18, Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Great choice.
Number 17, Queen of Earth, which I did not see.
Neither did I.
Number 16, Raw. Good choice.
Good choice. Great horror movie. Didn't make either of our runners up or anything, but excellent and scary.
Number 15, Poetry, which I did not see.
Didn't see it.
Number 14, La Fleur, which I only saw a portion of.
Okay. Because
it's a very long film. It's 13 and a half hours. Number 13, The Place Beyond the Pines.
Oh, yeah. That's been kind of forgotten a little bit.
Yeah, Derek Chan France kind of came out swinging and then just stopped. it's like two really impressive features and then just like hasn't been seen since.
That's an underrated crime film, though. I hope people seek that out.
Yeah. Number 12, The Handmaiden.
Great film.
Number 11, Snowpiercer.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm not a fan. I think Bong Joon-ho's other films are better. But
I think it's a little blunt, but I think it really, really works. I'm a fan. Didn't make my top 10 or nothing. But
Number 10, Computer Chess.
Ooh.
Did you see Computer Chess?
I hear it's really good.
Oh, yeah. That's a good bonkers
film. It's a documentary, right?
No, but it's in that style.
Okay.
Yeah. Number 9, The Meyerowitz Stories.
Oh, you know, I missed that. The Noah Baumbach
Film. Yeah, the Noah Baumbach film. Number 8, Inside Out.
Great pick.
That is an excellent film. Number 7, Green Room. Which hasn't been making a lot of top 10 lists.
No, but Green Room is a really good thriller. Mm-hmm. If you didn't see Green Room, it was the late Anton Yelchin as a punk rocker who gets trapped in the green room of a club for white supremacists. And he saw them commit a murder with his whole band, and they're trying to kill the whole band. Really cool film.
Number six, Arrival. I love Arrival.
Arrival's brilliant.
Number five, Certain Women, the Kelly Reichardt film.
Oh, that is a great... Yeah. That should have made my runner's up. Damn, I freaking feel bad leaving that out. Yeah. That's a really amazing film. There's a lot
I'm forgetting about this, about the decade. It was... If I'd been given another month, maybe.
Yeah.
Number four, Sierra Nevada.
Oh, I didn't... Yeah, I didn't see that one.
I'll describe it later.
Okay.
Number three, The Forbidden Room, the Guy Madden film.
That is a great, great, great choice.
I love Guy Madden, but I didn't see The Forbidden Room.
Oh, it's so cool. If you've never seen The Forbidden Room, Guy Madden, like, recreates silent movies that are, like, now lost, and the only evidence we have of their existence were, like, really short reviews and publications. So he's just trying to guess what he thinks they would be.
Oh, that is great.
It's really cool. That's
great. Number two, 2 Days, 1 Night.
Oh, yeah, you love that movie.
I love that movie.
Yeah.
And number one, I Wish... The Hirokazu Kore-eda film.
Oh, I need to see more Hirokazu Kore-eda films. Yeah, Hirokazu I'm really Kore-eda behind on his
filmography. Really wonderful.
Everyone tells me he's amazing. I'm really behind on his filmography. That is a really...
That's a solid list.
That is a sweet list you got right there. That is a list of someone who has sought out
the great
cinema.
Stuff. Yeah.
That doesn't make it better or worse than anyone else's, but that is a cool series of recommendations. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Here's a letter from Chris R.
Okay.
Another top 10 list. Hello, Luca and Sergio. This is a list of my 10 favorite movies from 2010s. I enforce a caveat here only to include movies that neither you named during your Best of the Decade episode.
Oh, okay.
And also for perspective, I am 20 years old. I am more than double that, so my taste might be a little different. But here we go. Number 10. Number 10, Unfriended.
Interesting choice.
Because every list needs a WTF choice. Number nine, Certified Copy, which I should have had on my runners-up. I like watching a relationship in Fast Forward. Devastatingly beautiful.
I never saw Certified Copy. You don't want to say about Unfriended? Mm. I liked that bold choice. There was this new sort of... it never quite caught on the way like found footage did, but of movies that take place entirely on a computer screen.
Yeah.
I think Unfriended was one of the first. It wasn't the first, but it was one of them.
Can we call it a window thriller?
Is that what they call it?
That's to coin a phrase.
I like it. Right. I think Searching has perfected that, near as I could tell, but Unfriended deserves a lot of credit.
Number nine was Abbas Kiarostami's Certified Copy, which I really like.
Yep.
Number eight, Mustang, one I had forgotten about.
Oh, yeah.
It's an ode to all the children who were forced to grow up too fast. Mustang was... like a feminist coming-of-age drama about this group of teenage girls who were forced all of a sudden they were pulled out of school and forced to live only at home and primed for marriage.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And how they reacted really, really badly to that.
Awesome.
Number seven, Assassination Nation.
Oh!
One of the first films to confront head-on many of the anxieties that personally affect us Gen Zers. Number six,
I think that's really exciting that there's a film out there that, like, we're starting to see, like, maybe, like, people in the older generation are recognizing it as such.
Oh, there you go.
I think that's really cool, yeah.
Number six is Melancholia.
Okay.
This movie gets it, man. number five, Patterson.
Oh, I love Patterson.
Pure comfort on film. I could watch Adam Driver drive a bus for 10 hours.
Hey, what are you doing? That was on the bookshelf. No bookshelf cat.
He wants
Knock
to read.
It over.
It's an intellectual cat. He wants to read your books.
I love Patterson. I watched Patterson and I totally fell in love with it. If you've ever seen it, Adam Driver plays a poet who drives a bus.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. That's the whole movie. Almost nothing happens in it. And it is so peaceful and relaxing. Mm-hmm. And it turns out there's an entire, like, genre of, like, Japanese anime that plays out a lot like Patterson, where it's just slice of life and relaxed and chill, and I've been getting really obsessed with it, and I love it. So Patterson was it was actually kind of a gateway film for me.
Okay. Number four is The Handmaiden. The only comment is yes.
Yes!
Number three, Hereditary. Elevated horror is a stupid term, and I'm not even sure what it means, but whatever it is, this is one of them.
Elevated horror is a term that people made up for when horror is really good, and they're no longer calling it horror because they're no longer comfortable calling it horror because they think horror has a stigma. It doesn't. It's just a horror movie happens to be really, really good and thoughtful. Mm. Hereditary is a brilliant film. I like it a lot. I think the ending oversells itself a smidge, but brilliant acting.
I'm fine with the ending. Yeah. Number two, Lady Bird.
Okay.
Comment, find a flaw. I dare you.
Has one of my favorite lines of the entire decade. Don't be a Republican.
Don't be a Republican. And number one, Black Swan.
Interesting.
And Natalie Portman's character said it was perfect. I felt that. Yeah. Black Swan freaked me the hell out.
Yeah.
Of the Aronofsky films that came out in the last decade, I chose Mother sort of his representative work, just because that's like his freakiest, most experimental thing.
Oh, I think it's Noah.
And well, no, Noah's freaky and experimental too. They're both these weird biblical freakouts.
Yeah.
I think Mother is like, it's like a college film that got way out of hand.
I think that's true for a lot of Darren Aronofsky. Yeah. I think almost every Darren Aronofsky movie is a college movie that got way out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we like about them. Yeah. Isn't it? those are cool choices. Thank you for that.
Here's a letter from Joshua, his top 10 list.
Okay.
Hello, Joshua. Hey guys, these are my top 10 films of the decade. And he sent a picture of the posters.
Okay, cool.
So I'm not sure what the ranking is here, but
okay, we'll just go through them.
The Place Beyond the Pines, again.
Hey, that's nice.
Arrival, again.
Great.
Roma, Boyhood.
Yep.
Ex Machina.
Okay, good choices.
The Master.
Great choice.
Which Avengers film is that? can't tell by the poster.
That is Endgame. That's the most recent one.
Okay, Avengers Endgame.
I can see that.
The Social Network,
yep.
Victoria, and Blue is the Warmest Color.
Okay. Excellent choices all around. Excellent choices all around.
What is Victoria?
Was that the
German film that was filmed in one take, or
I think it was. Hold on. We're showing our ignorance here.
It's the 2015 film, right? I think it's the one. Yeah, it's the
one. 2015. It's a crime thriller.
Yeah, it's the German film where it looks like it's like she leaves a party and like joins a bunch of ruffians on the street, and it looks like it's filmed in one take. I didn't see it, but I heard a lot of good things about that one. Well, good choice then. thank you for sending in.
No, thank you so much.
I'm looking for some other lists.
So I got. I love hearing everybody's choices because every once in a while, like, I'm surprised we had two. The Place Beyond the Pines. I thought a lot of people had forgotten about that one. Mm-hmm. But also, I love hearing some of these recommendations. Like, I'm writing down Victoria and Sierra Nevada. I need to track these down and watch them because I haven't yet.
Just thumbing through the Criterion collection, I'm seeing, or the Criterion channel, I'm seeing some of these, like, that I meant to see that I heard a lot of great things about, like Blanca Nieves. And, I think Sierra Nevada is on there.
Oh, cool.
Here is a letter from Ender. Hello, Ender.
Yep.
Ender writes, I miss being a kid.
Mm.
When I actually believed the Oscars held themselves to the highest standards. I was completely ignorant to Oscar campaigning and stubborn voters. Sadly, they have regressed themselves to that of the Golden Globes. In my world, there is no more glamour or respect for winning an Oscar. How are movies like Hustlers and The Lighthouse and Uncut Gems overshadowed by Jojo Rabbit? How on earth is Anthony Hopkins nominated but Kang Ho Song from Parasite or Willem Dafoe from The Lighthouse aren't? How the F is Jonathan Pryce favored for a role where his Spanish is dubbed, and then when it's speaking in English sounds nothing like Francis, just another generic attempt by an English-speaking actor to do a Latin accent?
His Spanish was dubbed?
Evidently so.
Wow, didn't know that one.
Al Pacino in Scarface wins this trophy. Eddie Murphy and Adam Sandler gave much more original performances. And lastly, how do you snub the likes of Robert Eggers, Greta Gerwig, Lorraine Scafaria, the Safdie brothers, Celine Sciamma, or Lulu Wang, but nominate Todd Phillips? Sorry to get emotional, but I really adored the Oscars when I was growing up, and it is sad to watch great films and performances be forgotten in favor of big studios pumping cash to get nominations. Saludos desde México.
Someone asked a question on Twitter that I was thinking about a bit. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember who it was, but the question was, what was the year and what was the film or what was the award where you lost your faith in the Academy?
Well, it took a while for me.
Yeah.
Because I was really paying close attention for a long time.
Yeah.
And they made a lot of choices that I didn't agree with. Like, they gave Best Picture to Gladiator, which is a film I dislike intensely.
Okay.
But even then, I felt that was, like, sort of a slip-up. Like, every
once in a while, there's a blip.
Decade and a half. There's, like, one just really bad one. It's like, okay, The Greatest Show on Earth has Best Picture.
Yeah.
That's not a Best Picture kind of movie. It's just, it's actually...
There was sentimental Cecil B. DeMille movie. Gladiator, we hadn't had that kind of big epic in a while. I actually like Gladiator.
And I watched
a lot,
Gladiator, and we still didn't have that epic. But when Crash won Best Picture, it's like there's something broken with this system.
Crash killed it for me as well. And I was pretty old. I was out of college by that point. And I knew the Oscars were inherently flawed.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, they are. They're people. But when I was really little, much like. Our writer, when I watched the Oscars, I remember the first Oscars I consciously remember watching, like consciously. It was the year Silence of the Lambs won.
All right.
And I know I'd watched them before then, but just like that one really, really stuck with me because I remember watching it and there were all of these nominees that I had heard of and or watched, like Silence of the Lambs, Beauty and the Beast. And then there were a ton that I hadn't.
Okay.
And I remember thinking to myself, shit, I gotta see that. I can't remember what was that, like Tom and Viv or something like that. It was one of those, you know, these kind of art house movies that had slipped by me. And because I was a kid and, you know.
Can't watch films like Tom and Viv.
Well, I could, but like, you know, we might have rented them or something like that. But they weren't being advertised to me. A lot of the movies that were nominated for the Academy Awards totally slipped me by. And I think that's one of the great values of the Academy Awards. Much like I love hearing your top 10 list of the decade is, oh, I need to see that, apparently. Like, I just, there's a lot of people who are really casual film enthusiasts. Either they're young or they're adults who simply do not follow the industry, which is, frankly, most adults. Yeah. Let's just be fair here. A lot of people consume movies the way a lot of us consume
fast food.
Fast food, kind of willy-nilly. You know, if it's good, awesome. If it's not, we had lunch.
Yeah.
You know, it's fine.
And for a lot, and just like fast food, for a lot of people, it's an impulse buy.
Yeah.
It's like, some people get really worked up around blockbuster season, like the summertime. They want to see a few big movies throughout the year, and they get really excited about those. But yeah, for the most part, people just sort of consume very casually.
This is why I get pissed off about snubs. On one hand, I just want great people to be rewarded for their work, but I also understand that art is subjective. The Academy is still very largely biased towards very certain groups. They've done a good job of mitigating that somewhat, but it's still
in certain years.
In certain years more than others, but like still like they're trying to get it a bit more representational of the actual industry. But it still clearly caters to certain demographics which are interested in certain kinds of films, like The Two Popes, which is fine, but like it's an Oscar-y kind of movie. But every time something like Hustlers doesn't get nominated for anything, or The Farewell doesn't get nominated for anything, that is literally millions of people who might never hear about it. Hustlers did okay, but Farewell really could have used the extra boost. Uncut Gems really could have used the extra boost. Lighthouse got nominated for Best Cinematography, as well it should have.
But that's it.
But that's it, and that is kind of crap. Willem Dafoe totally should have been nominated. What Oscar snubs really ticked you off this year?
Well, I mean, all of them. Portrait of a Lady on Fire wasn't submitted for the Best International Film from France. They chose Les Miserables instead, and did get nominated.
Which I have seen, and it's nowhere near as good as Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
It's still a fine film.
I think, actually.
We'll review it on the show eventually. Yeah. But, from what I understand, France doesn't have to submit it for that category for it to be eligible in other categories.
No.
So Celine Sciamma could have been nominated for Best Director.
And in fact,
leads could have been up for, both could have been up for Best Actress.
There were Oscar campaigns for Portrait of a Lady on Fire. It just was ineligible for foreign language film. But yeah, it should have been up for Actress, Supporting Actress, Director, Picture, Cinematography, at least.
Any of those
costumes.
Things.
Yeah. You know.
So that one really pissed me off, that The Lighthouse only got cinematography. Great cinematography. Yeah. Hope it wins.
Yeah.
Because it's the only one it's going to get. But, you know, not Willem Dafoe, not Robert Eggers for the screenplay.
The biggest, like, fuck you. There's one snub I actually appreciate, and that's Frozen 2. Because it's like, that would have been like the obligatory nomination for Disney, and they didn't go there, and I'm glad, because it's actually not that great a movie.
Well, what I like is that Disney Animation is now kind of second class to other studios.
Yeah.
Like, the big mainstream canonical Disney animated films aren't where their money is now. They're so busy focused on sort of their purchased IPs like Star Wars and Marvel.
Well, Frozen 2 made bank, and so did Toy Story 4, but I still think Toy Story 4 might still win it.
Toy Story 4 is quite good, but again, that's Pixar. Yeah. It's a different creative team. Disney distributes it, and they get the money for it.
I think that's a little bit more mixed and matched now, but yeah. But anyway, the one that really pissed me off is every woman who wasn't nominated for Best Director.
Yeah.
It's absurd.
Well, Greta Gerwig especially, but also Celine Sciamma.
Well, because Greta Gerwig's film was at least nominated for Best Picture, so it's kind of weird that it wasn't up for it.
I'd love to have seen Mati Diop, who did Atlantics, be nominated for Best director, even if Atlantis wasn't up for Best Picture.
It was considered a front runner for cinematography. A lot of people were surprised it didn't make it.
And because it is such a strange film that required such a careful directing job, and she did a really awesome job on that one.
That's how I feel about Chalene Sciamma. I don't feel like everyone could have done what she did for Portrait of a Lady on Fire. I don't feel like everyone could have done what Lulu Wang did for The Farewell. That requires an enormous amount of sensitivity to the characters and the cultures in which they live to even remotely pull off. Lorraine Scafaria, I think, did a crime movie on par with just about anything like Martin Scorsese's ever done. And Martin Scorsese gets in for The Irishman, but I feel like Hustlers is the one that feels like it's actually pushing the genre forward.
And you know, I'm a Scorsese fan, but I would not have been hurt if he was not nominated in this category.
No, nor I.
Because I think The Irishman is not one of his best films. It's a good film.
Yeah, it's good.
It's quite good. Yeah. It was on my runners-up for the best pictures of the year, but
I
wouldn't have been hurt if Scorsese was overlooked this year.
Completely. Like,
and
I
now
think,
we have not only is Scorsese nominated, but a guy who's ripping off Scorsese is also nominated.
If Todd Phillips beats Martin Scorsese for ripping off Martin Scorsese... Something's wrong.
Something's wrong.
We're, that's
like,
weird.
Like, the people who are electing aren't really paying attention to the broad scope of cinema.
Yeah.
Just sort of going with sort of what's
I'm
hot.
Fine,
I don't
I'm
know.
Fine with movies paying homage to other movies, but when your movie is literally just an homage to other movies, I think you need to be doing something more interesting with it. Like, you should be trans... Tarantino, to his credit, I don't like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I'm on the record on that. At the very least, he's taking all of his influences and making them his own and telling a different story with them and like doing something distinct. And I don't feel like Joker did that. I feel like Joker just did King of Comedy again, but with the Joker. That's not a bad idea.
I'm not 11 Academy Awards.
I don't hate that movie. Yeah. I don't think it's very good, but like, I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, the Oscars are disappointing. The Oscars kind of matter because the industry very much revolves around them, and they introduce a lot of people to these movies. So if a snub is a snub, it hurts.
In terms of American film posterity, the Oscars kind of matter.
Yeah,
if you're going
on the
for
books.
Like an actual barometer of quality. Go to the Indie Spirit Awards. Go to the Critics' Choice Awards. Go to bodies that are actually more. Go to Kaihaiju Cinema, for goodness' sake.
Well, yeah.
Or Sight and Sound. You know, these people who are actually concerned with the films that are moving the art forward, rather than simply.
I agree.
What we're going to put down on the books for posterity.
And I can I'll say this: two groups who every year make choices I respect, even if I don't agree with them. You mentioned them already. Independent Spirit Awards, and actually the Los Angeles Association of Film Critics. Angeles Film Critics Association, which I know several members. But I appreciate the approach that they take to their choices. They actually have long conversations about it. It feels like they're going a bit more in-depth when they make a choice than this just a simple blind ballot.
I'm so sick of the blind ballot. It's not a good way to select best films of the year.
And I imagine the Academy, it's nearly impossible because there are thousands upon thousands of members.
Exactly.
You can't get them all in a
room. To do a blind ballot for that. But LAFCA, which only has a finite number of members.
Yeah, a few dozen.
Gets them all in the as many of as they can anyway, in the same room together. And they actually, I like to picture it's, like, this big, like, Odeon-shaped tribunal where they're just sort of, like, in these prison seats, and they stand up and bang their shoes on desks in this darkened room, and they yell out nominees, "Oh, I think Mati Diop ought to get it. You are a fool, sir!"
Everyone's wearing powdered wigs.
Yeah, and they all have powdered wigs.
I like, there's this montage. I only just recently saw The Two Popes, because now for Academy Awards I'm trying to catch up, but, like, there's two elections for Pope. In that movie, because they're two popes. But every time they do it, it's like this weird kind of alien, like, and this person submits their nomination, and all of a sudden there's a ball rolls into a thing, and like a bit of red string gets spooled onto a cord, and I don't know what the fuck's going on.
It's like a Matthew Barney film.
Yeah, it's a little sort of... ancient in a way, and I imagine that
Roman Catholic Church.
No, I know. Well, yeah, and it was, but like I kind of want that from like my Critics Bureau. I want there to be incense burning, and I want maybe
that's how I picture
we sacrifice a VHS every year to the gods.
I'm not a member of LAFCA. I've applied. I've not been accepted.
Same.
I've only applied once though. I should probably apply a couple more times.
I've been trying for 10 years.
Yeah,
they do not want me.
But So I've never actually had a chance to go in and listen and see what that looks like. And, yeah. And I think they're pretty strict about, like, filming it. But
oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. They're open about tweeting about it, and yeah. I love hearing well,
once,
about it.
Once
yeah.
the winner is actually chosen. But I feel like a debate, like a critical debate like that, is a much healthier way to actually select best films of the year.
Because I want to be like, you know, someone to present something to me and I'd never thought of it before and then be like, well, I disagree. And they say, well, I think they should win for these three reasons. And I'm like, yeah, that's a good point.
Mm.
That's a great conversation to have. I'd love that. Anyway.
Right.
Anyway, moving on.
Here's a letter from Johannes. Hello, Johannes.
Hi, Johannes.
Dear Mr. Beast and Rockmeister McCool, greetings from Germany. Oh, guten Tag. I'm an editor in the German film industry, but my goal is to shift my career over to the United States at some point because I find the German film industry insanely frustrating.
Okay.
The main reason is the way movies are financed over here. Because the market for German cinema isn't that big, it's just Germany, Austria, and Switzerland, it's almost impossible to finance a movie independently and make a profit in the end. So most movies get financed through a combination of government subsidies and money from public television.
Yeah.
All these organizations then each have say in what the movie should be. So there's input from multiple committees, each with their own agendas, egos, and so on, and the result is a movie landscape filled with movies that look the same, feel the same, recycle the same tired plots and characters without any risk and with all the edges filed off. Is that a saying in English? I'm not sure. Yes, yeah. Having the edges filed off.
Yeah, totally a thing, yeah.
Understand. Every once in a while, there's a movie that manages to break through all the bullshit and still deliver a good product, but it's the exception, not the rule. That's the case in a lot of countries. A lot of film industries are financed by the government in other countries,
yeah.
Which is not something that... I guess there's, like, tax subsidies in America,
mm-hmm.
but for the most part, like, studios and investors, like, private investors fund movies.
It's considered strictly a capitalist enterprise by most people. But, yeah, there's a lot of countries out there who, if you want to make a movie in your country and you're not independently wealthy, and I don't even know what the rules are, there are government organizations that you can go to that will give you money for your various projects. I've talked to various filmmakers about, like, some of them, like, in New Zealand or
Canada,
Austria, and like, maybe was that Austria or Finland? But, I mean, I imagine that must be a really difficult process.
Yeah. Anyways, he says, I'm not against public funding for movies, uh-huh. not at all, but I think there has to be a way to do it without hindering artistic expression and risk-taking. There has to be a middle ground somewhere. I would be interested to hear what you think, because I'm not sure what that middle ground is. Also, are there any German movies from the last decade that broke through the system and made an impression on you? Mine are Victoria, Tony Erdmann, In the Fade, and System Crasher, or System Springer, from last year. I didn't see System Springer.
Neither did I.
Sorry for the long letter. Keep up the great work, Johannes. What is the middle ground? Like, how can you get public funding for movies? Well, in America, that's not happening. I think the private enterprise machine is just way too big for the U.S. government to come in and start financing films. You should watch Tim Robbins' film Cradle Will Rock.
Cradle Will Rock takes
place during the Works Progress Administration, which was put into place during the Great Depression to ensure people get government-funded work.
In the arts in particular.
The film is about the arts in particular, but the Works Progress Administration. But yeah, there was actually a federal theater project. The government was funding theater, so working actors and working performers would have work during the Great Depression. And unfortunately, this meant, and this film is exactly about what you're talking about, when a composer and he wrote the lyrics and the book and the music for a musical called Cradle Will Rock, Mark Blitstein, wrote The Cradle Will Rock. It was an aggressively political film about capitalism and the evils of the American system and the things that led to the Great Depression. And all of the people involved in the theater were really excited about it. And they were trying to put on this really big theatrical production. Star director Orson Welles was putting it together, and he was still just a kid at the time. This is before he made Citizen Kane. But he was still... he was already known for being, like, The Shadow, and it was about all these... Tim Robbins did his homework. All of the people in it were based on real people. So all of the actors, all of the financiers, everybody who was involved in this thing. And then...
I thought there was one weird, like, weirdly unnecessary character he fictionalized. I remember reading about it when it came out. But anyway, that's irrelevant.
Yeah, but there's, of course, some fictionalization. You know, there's a subplot with Rockefeller and Diego Rivera. the muralist.
Yeah.
Which, because Diego Rivera was hired by the government to do this big mural in a Rockefeller building, and Rockefeller was really concerned with the political messages in it.
Yeah, because he wanted to put some communist stuff in there because he was Diego Rivera. Well,
he wanted to paint Lenin on the poster, and you know, this isn't not kosher at the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was a congressman, his name was Congressman Dyes, and he, real-life congressman, who was really suspicious of these weird lefty things that were creeping into the art, and how you should do non-political art.
Well, and then and it started getting stupid. Like, at the beginning of the movie, you see two people who have, like...
Oh, they're dressed as beavers.
Yeah, they're dressed as beavers or squirrels, and, like, they're, like, their whole thing is, we're just gonna do a play for children, and it's about the importance of sharing. They're like... Okay, great, that's cute, do that. Mm. And then, like, halfway through the movie, their funding is taken away because sharing is socialist.
Yeah, yeah. Revolt of the Beavers, by the way, that was a real thing. That was not fictionalized for the movie. Somebody actually put together a musical called Revolt of the Beavers. I found a coffee table book.
The beavers are revolting!
You said it, they stink on ice. and it was about how the American government got so suspicious of art that they shut down the Federal Theater Project.
Yeah.
And this is about how American politics are just way too sticky to allow for the arts. And it's been a battle ever since the beginning. Is there a ground where we can use public funding to make films? Yes.
Sure.
We can just make it happen.
Yeah.
I think there's too many people in the American government who wouldn't allow it to happen, but there's no reason why it shouldn't.
True, and granted, like, a lot of films that are made under these systems are made under a variety of compromises. A lot of great films have been made under compromises. I don't think it's necessarily the best way to work.
Mm.
However, it hasn't stopped good films from being made entirely. And when it comes to German films of the 2010s, I'll be perfectly honest, I'm not as well-versed as I would like to be.
Okay.
I remember last year a film that I actually really, really admired, but... didn't quite make my best of list was Transit.
Oh, okay.
Which was an excellent film based on a World War II novel about fleeing fascist Europe that they decided to set in the present day because it's basically the same again. and that's a really excellent movie, and I highly recommend that. Mm. I saw a German film at Sundance in 2016 that I don't think
you went to Sundance.
I've been to quite a few Sundances. And in 2016, I saw a film that I don't think ever got distribution over here called Wild. Nothing to do with the Reese Witherspoon movie. That was about a woman who finds a wolf, like, in a park near her apartment and decides to capture it and keep it in her apartment. And rather than domesticating the wolf, she starts turning more feral. it's not a horror movie, although it gets very grim. I didn't love it, but I appreciated that it took some really, really big swings and tried to do some daring things.
I saw a terrific film near the beginning of the decade. I'm not sure if it was released in Germany in like 2009, because I saw it in 2011. It was called Young Goethe and Love.
Yeah.
In Germany, it was just called Goethe with an exclamation point. And I think it was a really good biography of Johannes Goethe during the writing of The Sorrows of Young Werther, if you've ever read the book.
And who hasn't?
If you were a melancholy college student, you've probably read The Sorrows of Young Werther.
I'm being mildly sarcastic. Okay. It's classic literature.
Yeah, yeah.
Some people have dedicated more time in their lives to it than others.
I'm trying to...
Well, listen, there's a lot of
other German films.
Well, it raises the question, honestly, of how much, you know, we like to think this is America, we can get everything, but a lot of stuff never comes here. Mm. It just doesn't.
Oh, you know what? There was a film that came out in like 2013 that I should have put on my runners up list for best.
Oh, yeah, what's that?
Called Wetlands.
Oh yeah,
did you ever see Wetlands?
No, I never did, but I remember hearing about it.
Yeah, it was about this wonderful, very frank look at the body and sexuality. Let me look it up. Who directed that one? David Venent is the name of the director. And that was a really terrific, really energetic, wonderful film about things that go bad during a shaving accident. And the young woman who is the victim of this shaving accident, how she kind of bonds with one of the nurses in the hospital. It's just really wonderfully kind of punk rock and sexually adventurous in a way.
That sounds cool.
That one was really good.
There's also a lot like, of a there's lot, a lot of
just, a lot just don't make it here. There's a lot of films like, you know, Ruben Fleischer and Roland Emmerich, who are German directors working in America.
There's a lot of German co-productions as well, and it's hard to say if those are made actually under the same like auspices. Like The Book Thief was a German-American co-production, but it's so American the way that it's presented. Also, it's not a very good movie. But anyway, but thank you for your letter. That was that was really interesting. I hope you find a way to navigate that, and I hope you find a way to work. Because if you have something to say and you want to say it and you want to make films, I think you should. So I hope we get to see your films.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And don't think that just coming to America, you're going to have more opportunities. You probably are, just because more films are made here than almost anywhere else. I think India has its beat.
It's still going to be hard.
It's still going to be hard.
But it might be hard in different ways, and that might seem like a step upward.
Yeah.
I don't know, though.
Let us know if working for, like, one megalomaniacal artist is better or worse than working for, like, a rank of committees who are dictating the content of the films.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised either way.
Here's a letter from Hayden. This is another list.
Hey!
Hello. The past year was the first one since 2015 that I didn't see over 100 newly released films.
Okay.
I only saw 79.
That's still pretty good.
That is a respectable number.
Yeah,
all right?
No one should be ashamed of that. That's a lot of movies.
If you see one movie a week, you're doing great.
Yeah.
But from the crop I did see, I came away thinking 2019 was a very decent year for movies.
Indeed.
So much, in fact, I made a top 20 instead of a top 10. For the sake of length, I'll only be listing the films and not commenting on them. Prepare to disagree, because my list contains at least one film I know either one of you hated.
Great.
So, number 20, The Art of Self-Defense.
I like that movie a lot. Wish I had more opportunity to talk about it. I think it is a really, really excellent subversive film about toxic masculinity. Yeah. I think it's really, really good.
It looked up my alley, and I sat on
it. I haven't seen the agency then.
Number 19, The Beach Bum.
Ah, I missed that one.
Harmony Korine makes another film about filth. And filth is good in that movie.
Yay!
Number 18, Her Smell.
Still haven't seen it.
Number 17, Avengers Endgame. Number 16, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
I just saw that. Really, really sweet movie. Liked it a lot.
It's sweet. It's light.
That's where I'm going to go. It is light, but I think it's very sweet.
Number 15, Climax. Good job.
Not my favorite.
I did Climax.
I didn't like
number
it.
14, Loose. Didn't see.
Okay.
Number 13, High Life. Love High Life.
Mm-hmm.
Number 12, Parasite. I love Parasite.
Great movie.
Number 11, Us.
Great movie. Made my top 10.
Yeah. Number 10, Dr. Sleep.
Yay. I love Dr. Sleep. Whitney's wrong about a lot of things sometimes.
Man, Dr. Sleep is a dumb vampire.
It's not dumb vampire. It's smart.
There's ghost juice in thermoses in that movie. It is stupid.
Where else are you going to put it?
Number 9, Knives Out.
Great movie.
Number 8, Booksmart.
Yep.
Yes. Number 7, Uncut Gems.
Yep.
Number 6, One Cut of the Dead.
Oh, I haven't seen that yet.
I haven't seen it yet either. I've heard a lot of good things about it. Number 5, The Lighthouse.
Yay.
Number 4, Midsommar, The Director's Cut, which I haven't seen.
I haven't seen The Director's Cut either. Yeah.
Number 3, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. No comment.
Boo.
Number 2, Under the Silver Lake.
I missed this. I've heard the legends.
I only saw half, so I can't comment. Again, it was just circumstances, not because I disliked it. And number 1, Marriage Story.
Okay.
Marriage Story was your number 1.
All
right.
Marriage Story hit some people harder than others.
Yeah.
Me, all I saw was a pretty good drama, but I know a lot of people who have been really deeply affected by it.
Mm-hmm.
So fair enough. That's a solid list.
Mm-hmm.
I disagree with a couple of those. At least one of those ended up on my worst of the year. I also know I'm in the minority on that, so fair enough.
Okay, here is a question from JP.
Hi, JP.
Dear Bibbs and Whitney, I have to disagree with Bibbs. When he said, quote, seeing the world not as it really is, but through the veil of depression, because that is exactly the problem. Studies have shown that most people who are overtly optimistic about the world around them, and particularly their place in it, in surveys more than half the population think they're more attractive, more intelligent, or even luckier than the average, usually by a wide margin, which is clearly impossible, statistically.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, the fact that lotteries are huge money spinners is evidence of this. Most people probably realize they have very little chance of winning, but will buy in anyway. Telling a depressive to, quote, be realistic is the wrong thing for you to say, because they usually are being realistic. The problem is when those expectations become self-perpetuating. I probably won't succeed, so I won't even try. at which point failure is inevitable. Convincing people to keep trying anyway is probably the best advice you can offer. Speaking for myself, I would say that setting yourself small attainable goals, as in go for a walk in the park, read a new book, clean the kitchen, etc., is probably helpful, as it shows you can succeed, if only in a small way. While you probably won't become a millionaire, marry a supermodel, or become president, you can make your life a little bit better, and that can help you to keep trying, JP.
That's a matter of perspective. Mm-hmm. I can appreciate that. That's not how I view depression, and granted, I'm no expert. I know my depression and what I've discussed with various therapists and what I've read, but when I said that, I didn't mean to say that like optimism is reality. Or that the opposite of depression is reality. What I mean to say is that when I, for example, am depressed and I think that everything is miserable and there's literally no point in doing anything. Why even bother? Why am I here? Nobody likes me. That's not me accurately gauging reality. That is me looking at reality through a perspective of pessimism and cynicism. That's not to say that pessimism and cynicism are never
connected directly to depression.
Yeah, that's not, or that there's no ever that they have no validity whatsoever in any sort of thought process or discourse. But the idea that I am depressed, but my depression is the way things should be. That's what I'm talking about. When you say that, like, I'm depressed. Why? Because I'm thinking clearly. That's not necessarily the case. Being sad is part of the human experience, and it should not just be avoided. And the opposite of depression isn't ecstasy. For me, it's just living. it's just going about your day. I think we're talking about the same thing in a different way, because you're talking about, you know, setting attainable goals, being reasonable. But for me, the idea that seeing the world purely as something that is cynical, that is out to get you, in which I don't have a part. It took a really, 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 really long time to learn that when people suggest otherwise, they're not lying to me. That's what I'm talking about. But I try to talk about mental health a lot because I went through a lot of my life with it being heavily stigmatized and making me feel really isolated and alienated and alone. And that really amplified all of my feelings of depression and anxiety. So that doesn't mean I necessarily have all the great insights in the world, but I am glad we're allowed to have this conversation and that we're comfortable having this conversation and that we can share ideas about this. Clearly, we have somewhat different ideas about depression, but I think we're hovering around the same basic idea. So if I articulated myself in a way that made it seem like I was suggesting euphoria is the ideal state, that's not what I meant. What I mean is, when you're depressed, it doesn't mean that you're necessarily viewing the world the way it is. Depression can be the symptom of something. You know what I mean? Like, all those feelings can be the symptom of depression, rather than depression is a symptom of reality. You know what I mean?
A little bit. I think my depression functions different than most people's.
That may be the case. May be the case. I'm just saying, depression is not... I don't think depression is a symptom of seeing the world the way it really is. I think depression is a symptom of depression.
Yeah. There's... We get a lot of questions. I get a lot of questions, anyway, from people who ask me, like, if you're feeling really down, if you're really depressed and life is just gray, what films do you watch to make yourself feel better? It's like, that's not the way a film works for me. I can't just watch a film and feel better.
Yeah.
The world is still gray while I'm watching it, and it's gray outside when the film's over. It doesn't matter how great that film is. It's not going to cut through. It's just going to bounce off my skin. So what I need to do is watch really harrowing, depressing stuff when I'm in a good mood. And that way I have, like, emotional... the correct emotional vocabulary to deal with it when it comes up.
Yeah, sometimes I think we look at, like, when we think about, like, what's a movie you can watch? What's a song you can listen to that'll cheer you up when you're sad? And sometimes if you're sad about something kind of straightforward, that can be enough. Just like, oh yeah, everything's going to be okay, blah, 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 blah. But if you're really, really, really down in the dumps, it may sometimes, and this is something I struggle with because I think of avoiding sad things as a survival tool for me.
It's a coping mechanism.
But like I'm learning gradually that, you know, being confrontational with your feelings can actually have a greater long-lasting impact than just putting on an Aqua album and rocking out. Like, it may be a little better for me to watch a sad movie than it is for me to watch a happy one sometimes. But
I'll put on Elias Marish's Begotten.
Oh god.
And then put on turn off the sound and then put on the best of Dr. Demento and listen to them simultaneously.
Oh my god, that's the most weird perverse thing.
And your brain doesn't know what to do, and it breaks through whatever your mood is. Because confusion is the most basic state of the human mind.
Your brain will just chisel its way out of your skull like Shawshank Redemption.
I'm
and just
here,
get out
man.
Like I'm gone.
I'm getting some Taco Bell.
Oh, God.
Here's a letter from Michael Rich.
Hello, hi, Michael.
Michael Rich. I read your whatever you sign off your letter as. That's what I'm going to read. So, dear Bibbs and Whitney, thank you for bringing me much joy as I enjoy binging your podcast. You make my workday so much more enjoyable, considering that some days I don't have much work to do. That sounds like a kind of a blissful workday. Therefore, it makes my work hours go by much more faster. I have been getting more into podcasting the last few years. The two that I listen to most is Philadelphia Film Critics Circle and Fictional Frontiers, although I strictly listen to the James Bernardelli interviews. I recently started to listen to the old B-Movies podcast, The Earliest Cutoff Point, and Linoleum Knife, and also a horror-themed podcast called Last Podcast on the Left.
Oh, I hear that's a good one.
Yeah. Sorry to know that What the Flick got canceled, though I dropped off with Breakfast All Day. Yeah, I was about to say, they're Breakfast All Day now.
Yeah, they're doing that.
When it comes to your Canceled Too Soon podcast, let me just say it brings me joy to know certain shows that I've never heard of and thankful certain shows that I never will watch. Although Profit and Man and Machine sound interesting.
Yay!
But of those, you reviewed Pitch and Almost Human are two of six shows that were canceled after one season that I left feeling legitimately cheated were canceled. The other four were John Doe, Terra Nova, Forever, not to be confused with Amsterdam.
Yeah, no, the immortal one, yeah.
And Kid Nation. Look up Kid Nation, dear listeners, because that was a fiasco from the start.
That was a hell of a choice.
Hope you review those at some point. Whiskey Cavalier, Alcatraz, and Journeyman, I just saw the trailers for and said to myself, nope, that is not going to get that is going to get canceled. Bucky O'Hare, I remember vaguely as from when I was a child, strolling through the children's section of my local video store, but never renting. Bucky O'Hare is all right.
Bucky O'Hare's fine. It's weird. It's I liked it when I was a kid.
Strange.
It's got a great theme song. Yeah.
Questions. One.
Yeah.
I think at times you may be a little too hard on UPN. How could we be?
We call it the failinest network in TV history. I think we might be a little hard on UPN.
I'm not saying UPN was the greatest thing since sliced bread or anything, considering that I remember UPN mostly for their Black Urban Family comedies. Granted, they're not all great. Moesha, Half and Half, The Parkers, Girlfriends, Malcolm and Eddie, Eve, One and One, and All of Us. And the greatest animated show ever, Dilbert. All hail Dilbert.
I remember they had Dilbert on.
I like Dilbert.
That's actually a really good point. And that's something we haven't really talked about with UPN because UPN is typically considered like all they really had was Star Trek. And
Star Trek was like their one hit.
But they that's a really good point. We didn't really talk about it because those are their successful shows.
I think
we don't really talk about a lot of this. Like, Moesha was a big hit. Like,
It was a modest hit.
People remember Moesha. UPN wasn't even in, like, not every place in the country even had UPN. Mm. So UPN was only ever, their most successful show could only ever be so successful.
Yeah.
So they were already struggling, like, just from that sheer fact of their existence. But these shows developed a clear and consistent, you know, audience that followed them, that this was an underrepresented market and demographic and...
Black Urban Family comedy.
And like, seriously, touche. Well stated. We haven't brought their shows up because they lasted longer. Mostly those were popular shows. But yeah, that's a good point.
When it comes to dramas outside Star Trek, without having to look it up on Wikipedia, I could list The Love Boat, The Next Wave.
We've been looking for The Love Boat, The Next Wave, actually.
And The Twilight Zone, hosted by the very bored-looking Forrest Whitaker. who looked like he showed up on set for 5 minutes, then promptly left.
Yeah, that's about right.
I like that new version of The Twilight Zone. I think it's fine. I think I only saw one episode of it.
It's
way better than Jordan Peele's. Jordan Peele's is not good.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe it'll improve. They did renew it, but yeah. I've seen some of his new ones.
Fair.
It's like it started okay, and then they just got bad, and the writing just got worse and worse.
I don't know why. It's so hard to capture what Rod Serling like.
Yeah,
had.
Well,
like
he had such a very particular like that.
He just had a very particular tone. Like even Jordan Peele, it's a different tone. Mm. He tells different kind of stories. Like I haven't seen it, but I know he tells different kinds of stories because I know the kind of stories Rod Serling tells, and I've seen a lot of Jordan Peele stuff. They're different folks. Yeah.
And secondly, second question.
Yes.
And final question. Could Siskel and Ebert be made today with the advent of film criticism as it is now? And also, who do you prefer, Gene or Roger? Sincerely, okay. Michael Rich. P.S. Apologies for the length. Don't apologize for the length.
Never apologize for the length. Second question first. I was actually always a Siskel fan. I know that sounds like weird sacrilege, but Ebert, like, you know, he lived like another like 15 years after Gene Siskel passed away, and he was very prolific, and for a lot of people in like our generation or younger, he was then the eminent film critic of his generation. But for a long time there, Siskel was right there with him, and I appreciated Siskel's approach and the way that he bounced off of Ebert, and I think I agreed with Siskel a little bit more often. But it's been a long time since I've actually read a lot of Siskel's stuff, so I couldn't speak about it too eloquently. I just remember liking Siskel a wee bit better.
Yeah. Siskel was, I think, a detail guy.
Yeah.
He liked little plot points. He liked a single performance. He took a filmmaking as sort of a collection of little details that were assembled together.
Yeah.
Roger Ebert, who I kind of, when I was becoming a critic, was like kind of emulating him mostly.
A lot of people were.
Was
big, you know, picture guy.
It was a big. He liked sort of an overall feeling, a tone of what the film left him with, and he could point to those little details and say those are some neat things within this, but this sort of overall notion of what the picture was unto itself, like this kind of platonic version of the movie.
What
he was concerned with. And I realized years after I'd been writing that that's what I was also doing.
It's weird as I'm always finding myself kind of halfway. Like I tend to talk about like the big stuff, but then I get really wrapped up in nuts and bolts sometimes. Like I used to be a big structure guy, like more so than I am now.
And you still are to a degree because you came from screenwriting school.
Yeah.
So you're concerned with the way a screenplay needs to function in order for it to be good.
Yeah. As for your other question, could Siskel and Ebert like become a thing today? I don't know if it's even easy to say that because the discourse that we have around cinema now, I think, is very specifically because we had Siskel and Ebert.
Yeah.
We had had film critics on TV before, but it was usually like one talking head on the news or maybe like a short thing in like public television. Gene Shalit is a very famous one, but like just basically someone just says, and these new movies are out. This one's pretty good. This one has a pun. And like that was that was what we had. Mm-hmm. And what Siskel and Ebert brought into, I mean, it wasn't like the biggest show ever, but it was the only show of its kind. It was, it aired on, in my market, like on Sundays, like right before 60 Minutes. So a lot of people were at home and watching. And what it brought into the household was two things. Every movie. Like, you would just hear about every movie. The little movies, the big movies, they'd always be the first two big ones right off the bat. But then the second half of the show would be about independence and foreign films. And so all of a sudden, you're more aware of the wider landscape of cinema than you might be otherwise. And you could learn a lot without even seeing the films. You'd know of their existence and you'd be interested and wait for them to hit home video. But the real thing that they brought in was what we would now call, sometimes derogatorily, the discourse. And they would actually have a frank discussion about the merits of art and what was good, bad, ethical, unethical, quality, low quality. And I think that a lot of the media that we consume today that is about art, specifically about cinema, uses that as a framework.
It's
basically having a conversation between one or more people. Even a lot of the talking head stuff is kind of framed as though there is an assumption of an audience's reaction. You know, oh, I know what you're thinking, blah, blah, blah. But like, it's about having a conversation in public and sharing ideas and bickering sometimes and being entertaining as we discuss art. And I think that's, I can't even imagine today's entertainment industry without what Ebert and Siskel did.
Well, and not just because they sort of pioneered it, because what do you think we're doing right now?
Literally
right now. What do you think every single vlog is? What do you think every single nerd podcast is?
Yeah.
That's all because of Siskel and Ebert. Could it happen? It's happening.
Yeah.
It's still happening. It's happening constantly. And if you're referring to the notion of maybe a few star critics taking the limelight and kind of acting as more or less the tastemakers of the nation, if you want to put it that way. No, I think film criticism is far too scattered right now. There are, of course, many, many amazingly talented film critics writing right now, way better than me, who are writing for big rags, who are pushing the discourse and finding things and are just excellent writers. And I encourage that you find a lot of these people and just find the people who are being published regularly, because they are all doing exceptional work.
Yeah.
But none of them has really risen to the ranks that Siskel and Ebert did. And I don't think they ever will. We have Leonard Maltin. We still have Leonard Maltin.
He's preeminent.
He is the elder statesman of the craft right now. He's just got a really prestigious award. He's still having some really important conversations. I disagree with him 98% of the time. I would love to sit down and have a conversation with Leonard Maltin.
For me, it's more like 70, but yeah.
Because I would bicker that guy. I remember he had like a call-in show once, or it was like an Instagram thing. Type in a question, and the question they were putting out to the audience was, "What films would you like to discuss with Leonard Maltin?" And people were putting in his favorite movies, and he's a big fan of the Golden Age of Hollywood. I want to talk to you about All About Eve.
Yeah.
I want to talk with you about Bringing Up Baby. I want to talk to you about Dumbo, or you know, any Disney animated film, because he loves those movies. I would love to sit down and talk with Leonard Maltin about Spring Breakers, a film he hates. That is caustic and confrontational and difficult and something that he is just not on the same wavelength as. But yeah. I would love to have a conversation with Leonard Maltin about something like that.
Yeah.
Spring Breakers, I put it on my runners-up of the best of the decade. It is a gross movie, and that's why I put it on there.
No, I admire that movie a lot, actually.
I was tempted to put Trash Humpers on my list just because it's even more confrontational.
Was that this decade?
Yeah.
It was like 2010 or something?
Let me look up Trash Humpers. I think it was this decade.
I think it's right in the coattail. It might be 2009, but anyway. We had famous critics, but I think, I'm trying to imagine.
It was 2009, I apologize.
I think if no one had thought to put two film critics on television talking about film as a show, and if they had chosen film critics who had a little less chemistry than Siskel and Ebert did, people would still be talking about movies, but I don't think it would be the industry it is now. I think if someone just started to now, I just don't know what the base point would be. I think everything would be. I think honestly, think Siskel and Ebert at the movies, I think, changed the industry in unquantifiable ways. Just the way we talk about it and the way that we build ancillary art and writing about it is just all them. But interesting to think about.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love those alternate reality things. It's fun.
Anyway, if you recall, 1B Peterson has been cataloging 100 films.
Ah, yes.
And this is a part of a project. Anyway, Bibbs and Whitney, I've been thinking a lot about a subject I thought would be a more regular conversation in the film community, but turns out to be quite taboo, and that is piracy. Piracy is a crime, undoubtedly. It also happens every day.
Mm-hmm.
My question is this. Is there a valid argument in favor of piracy? I've heard three that I cannot discount altogether. One, growing up, I had friends that lived along or below the poverty line. To them, being able to afford Netflix back in 2010 was a luxury. Some of them were cinephiles, and while they could rely on the libraries for classics, they would pirate new films because they couldn't afford to go to a theater. Two, I'm currently going to film school in a city where there is exactly one theater that plays only the largest releases.
Yeah.
Consequently, there's a group of students in my class who get together to watch pirated copies of art house films that would never be released in a theater within hours of where we live and won't be available to buy or rent until long after the year and the time and time the best of our year lists for it. Three, I have a friend who pirates only the films of filmmakers she cannot bring herself to support financially because she does see as culturally relevant, such as Roman Polanski, Woody Allen, more recently, any and all Weinstein productions.
Okay.
To the first two arguments, I say that, as unfortunate as having to wait is, I was going to mention that, we have a moral responsibility to wait. This is true. To the third situation, however, I can't just say that she should give money to these people who are undoubtedly some degree of monster. Seriously, Polanski can go and die for what he's done. It's an ugly thing, but I do think that ignoring the conversation isn't going to help anything. I've never heard any high-profile critics or filmmakers speak on the topic and would be very interested to hear your thoughts. Thank you, and see you on the next one, B. Peterson.
Okay, piracy is a big, big, big conversation, and it's not as cut and dry as those little bumpers in front of the DVDs we all bought.
Steal handbag.
And all these people with their stolen handbags are like watching this video going, well, yeah, okay, I guess I should
You wouldn't steal a human heart, would you?
Oh, God. My wife stole my heart. Should she be pirated?
No, they did a spoof of that on a Futurama DVD. And it's like, you wouldn't steal a handbag. You wouldn't steal the crown jewels, and then Bender is doing those
things. Of course
things.
He's doing it.
You would steal a human heart. Yes, I would.
There's a lot of different rationales. The basic rationale is this. Art has value, and I mean beyond the actual art itself. We want to live in this pure ideological zone where all art should be free. That's fine, but artists need to work and make money and pay their bills too. So if you can give money to an artist for their work, you should. And if you don't think their art has financial value, then clearly it's not worth watching. I'm sorry, to an extent, that much is true. And so if there's just a matter of, I know how much releasing distribution can suck at various parts in the country. You have to drive really far out of your way to see certain films. Some films never make it to your area. You have to wait for home video. That all sucks. And I'm sorry about that. But I also think that, like, you know, if you can't see Robert Eggers's The Lighthouse, that's not Robert Eggers' fault, and the people who made that movie probably do deserve money whenever you do see it.
Now, when it comes to, like, if you're incredibly impoverished,
yes,
and you want to see classic films, libraries are your greatest resource.
True.
Provided you have a good library. Libraries are good, however, about getting films or stock if you ask for it.
Yeah, just ask, and they'll try to get it from another library.
They can get it from another branch, they can get it from another city, or they can just order it if it's in their budget, which may not be, but it's likely that they take suggestions. So, if you can't afford these overwhelmingly expensive and increasing streaming services, then, your library is your best bet. You have to have you have to buy a working TV and a working video player, and you're set.
Yeah. There's
as for being in film school and having to wait, just wait.
Yeah.
Pirating new films is just sort of the dick thing to do there, and you're only doing it because you're impatient. And if you're doing it to make a top 10 list, that's not a good enough reason.
If your teacher gives you an assignment for a film that you are incapable of tracking down, and God help you, you needed to pirate it. I'm not going to judge you too harshly, but your teacher probably shouldn't have given you that assignment.
No.
Your teacher should make sure you have access to the things that they actually want you to watch. There are other instances, though. One which you discussed, actually, was the asshole rule, where you don't want to give them money because they don't deserve money.
Yeah,
because if you're paying for Woody Allen's, you know, movies, you're ultimately donating to his legal defense fund. I get that. And I'm not going to, I think there's still, like, the counter argument still basically applies, but on the other end of the spectrum, I don't have a particularly good, larger argument against that, and I totally get it. I know a lot of people who have a rule that, like Hitchcock was a fucking creep. He's also dead.
His ashes are in the Pacific Ocean.
He's very dead. So your money isn't going to his defense fund. You're not screwing over anyone, really. It's, you know, if you want to still have like a twinge of guilt about watching the movies, I get it.
Yeah.
But at that point, maybe it's a bit of a moot point. But right now, Roman Polanski probably doesn't need the money. I get it.
Yeah.
The other, but there is one more actual really, really good argument in favor of piracy.
Okay.
When there's no legal way to get the movie.
When there's no legal way to get it, or more significantly to what's happening today, especially with all these big streaming services that are launching and claiming to have big archives and don't.
Yeah.
If a studio is withholding a film from you, and there's no way to get it.
Yeah.
an archivist is now, or a pirate is now an archivist.
If they're working in those movies,
working,
yeah.
If they're working in a kind of movie that is, yeah, not available any other way,
yeah.
They are the ones who's keeping those films alive. They're the ones keeping it in the conversation. The studio, who's earning no money from a pirate, should be grateful to the pirate for keeping their film in the consciousness.
Yeah, because then if there's no demand for it if nobody knows it exists. Mm-hmm. If people know it exists and they're actually seeking it out and they can see it and say, wow, this is really, really good. I wish I could get a good version of this. Yeah, the studio should be really, really grateful in that instance.
Here's the rule. And
yes, this is a very important rule.
You can get bootleg DVDs. You can get, you know, rip streams or whatever. If you are able to buy a bootleg or download something illegally because it's not available and no studio has ever put it out, then I'm going to say you're welcome to do that. But if the studio does notice that a lot of this show or this movie is being talked about and they decide to put out a legit version, you are now responsible for buying a legit version.
Yeah.
To make up for the fact that you actually pirated it earlier.
Yeah, because the only reason you were pirating it in the first place is because you couldn't do so legally. So that it's available legally, you kind of owe the money on that. Mm-hmm. I think that's the rule. Yeah.
Here's something I also want to encourage, and it's not quite the same thing as piracy, but it is playing with the numbers a little bit.
Are you theater hopping again?
I'm theater hopping again.
I don't agree with you on this one, but I know why you're talking about
it. I advocate it 100% because if you want to see some big giganto blockbuster doesn't need your money. Star Wars doesn't need your money. They'll be fine. There, you know, a billion people are seeing this movie. But maybe The Lighthouse does need your money. And I think the only way studios see if people are actually watching movies, first of all, they are paying attention to Twitter, but more than anything, they're looking at box office receipts. So I have long encouraged the behavior of going to a multiplex, paying for a ticket for the small indie that needs your money, and then going into a different theater that's showing the big blockbuster that doesn't need your money. This is especially true if you've already seen the movie.
Yeah, if you're going to say it again, yeah. I can understand.
It's really
real mixed feelings about this one, man, I gotta tell you.
And because they're automating so much of multiplexes now, it's easier to do than ever before.
That's true. The only way anyone's really going to bug in a lot of multiplexes is if you're sitting in their seat and you won't move.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get it. And there's something real high school rebel about that I know you find really super appealing. Mm. But part of me would rather you just see the independent movie and, in addition to giving it the money, actually contribute to the conversation around it. Mm. But I see your point. Yeah, piracy is not nearly as cut and dry as a lot of people would have it be. And again, I think the archivist argument is the best argument. Mm. Because, yeah, if you're really trying to scour film history, you're going to find that as we move more into the digital streaming realm, a lot of studios don't give a shit about a lot of their own product. Mm-hmm. They just don't. I would love to recommend people see a film called Tag the Assassination Game. Really fun 1980s comedy/horror film about a fake game of, like, assassin where people, like, shoot each other with dart guns on a college campus, where one of the contestants has a psychotic break and starts killing people for real, and nobody knows. So they think everyone else is having fun, and he's actually killing people. Yeah. Stars a young Linda Hamilton, like before she was in Terminator.
Nice.
I think it was the directorial debut or the second film from Nick Castle, who would go on to do The Last Starfighter. Fun movie.
And who was also Michael Myers, incidentally.
The original Michael Myers and then the new Michael Myers as well. He was one of the people who played him in the latest film.
That's right. They brought him back. They brought him back.
I thought that was cool.
There are a lot of films that are just not available.
You can't find Tag the Assassination Game. So if you can find a crappy VHS rip on YouTube, that's it. That's the only way to see it. I'm not going to complain that you saw that.
I also want to fold in, this is going to enter a gray area, but there are some films that have been given some really awesome DVD releases or really awesome Blu-ray releases, and they go out of print real fast.
Yep.
And then the only way to get them, and because nobody lives near video stores anymore but us, is to go on like Amazon or eBay and pay, you know, shell out $100 for a single movie. I don't want to encourage anybody to pay $100 for a single movie, even if you really love it. Spend it on something more useful.
Well, because that money isn't going to the artists anyway. Yeah, it's going to people who collect. There's a collector's market for that, and I get that. And if you have the money, by all means. But at the same time, you should be able to see the goddamn movie.
Yeah. So I don't want to encourage piracy in an instance like that, but I can understand why you might want to.
My fundamental rule is this. If you can see it legally, see it legally. Yeah. If you will be able to see it legally soon, mm-hmm. it's not like you'll never be able to or you have no idea, but it's just a matter of waiting for it to be on home video in 2 months. Wait.
Just, yeah.
If you absolutely, unless there's some weird emergency where you absolutely have to, just wait. And if it's not available in any current medium, like, oh, you can get it on VHS or whatever, but mm-hmm. like, those are all secondhand copies now, no matter what. I'm not going to judge you for pirating a film.
Okay.
But only then. That's the one time where I'm going to be like, yeah, I'm not going to judge you at all for that. I don't think there's a big counter-argument for it. Let's move on.
Okay. Here is... this is about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, so I guess, William, you'll have to take this.
Once again, Whitney has to bow out of this because of his connection to Quentin Tarantino.
I work for Quentin Tarantino, so I can't comment. Dear Bibbs and Whitney, I'm going to sign off this time because I don't want to be called name redacted again, even though it would be kind of cool to be mysterious and anonymous, but I'm not cool, so I'm going to sign off.
The unknown commenter.
This is Alan.
Hi, Alan.
I wanted to compare and contrast two movies I saw on DVD recently, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down.
Oh, I haven't seen Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, though, so that's going to be complicated.
Let's read this letter anyway. Let's do our best. It's easy to see what's common to these movies. Violence against women. William, you objected to Brad Pitt assaulting a girl in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I don't have a problem with it because the girl was a member of the Manson family, armed with a knife, entering a house intent on killing people. If a girl is coming at me intent on killing me, I'm not going to be such a gentleman to her. Compare that to Antonio Banderas in Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, who kidnaps a woman, assaults her, and leaves her tied up when he leaves, all in an attempt to get her to love him, and worse, at the end of the movie, she did love him, which pissed me off no small amount. I have to believe that if I were a woman, it would piss me off even more. Either Banderas or the director Almodovar defended the movie in an interview by saying, "What the hell do you think happened in Beauty and the Beast?" And that's a kid's movie. Fair enough, but at least the Beast didn't assault Belle or leave her tied up.
She wasn't allowed to leave.
Yeah. To end with a question for Bibbs, what's your review of Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, and place it in context with your review of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Again, I haven't seen Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, so I'm at a loss here, and I apologize for that. That sucks. Whitney, without bringing up Once Upon a Time, have you seen Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down?
It's been a long time.
Okay.
There's a weird sort of psychosexual element to a lot of Almodovar's films from that era, from like the 80s, where if you've ever seen Matador or several others, there's this kind of playful fairy tale type tone to his movies that I think takes the curse off of it. And I think their comparison to Beauty and the Beast is apt. Because that is about essentially Stockholm Syndrome. A lot of critics have noticed that recently, especially when the live-action remake came out. Wait a minute, this is just about a beast who keeps a woman hostage. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's always been the story.
Yeah.
And the idea is that she's so good-hearted that she transforms him rather than him murdering her.
Yeah. At least that's how it's supposed to work.
Yeah. And that's actually a common trope in a lot of older literature. Like, have you ever read Pericles, Prince of Tyre, the Shakespeare play?
No.
There's a bit where a teenage girl is kidnapped by pirates and sold into sexual slavery. And she's thrown into a cell, and the evil pimp says, "Ha ha! I'm going to send all these men in, and they're going to have their way with you." And she's like, "Send them in. I'm just going to talk to them." And Shakespeare is such a powerful poet that the men come in, is like, "Okay, I'm here. I am to do my business." And she ends up talking to them and ends up having them like leave ashamed that they ever visited a brothel and swearing to living a good life.
Yeah.
So yeah, this idea that it's a sexist notion, but I think it's also empowering that a woman can be so overwhelmingly good that they can sort of transform the captor and develop some sort of emotional bond. And I think that's what Almodovar is getting at in kind of a kinky context.
Right. Again, you can talk about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And again, I apologize for not being able to really do this assignment the way that you want me to. But knowing what I know of Almodovar and how... he does work in a certain heightened reality in a lot of his work. And indeed, Tarantino is too, but he's also working in a recognizable reality because he's using real people.
Yeah.
And once you start bringing in the reality of it, especially in a relatively grounded film up until that point, you start getting into a wonky area where the film can't entirely exist on its own terms. It also has to exist in terms of our familiarity with the context. Mm-hmm. Now, in the context of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio kill the Manson family murderers. This movie's been out for a while. It made over $100 million. I'm assuming people know the ending. There's a certain catharsis that I think a lot of people are projecting onto the film because we know all about the Manson family murders and how horrible they were. And that's true. And I get that. But I am also looking at within the context of the actual narrative of the film, where Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio, people invade their home. They're also comical fuck-ups. So the way that the movie treats them in this sequence is as the brunt of a joke. They're not as a legitimate threat to these guys. Why? Because Tarantino has lifted these guys up into a vaunted, macho, masculine status. Their careers might not be great and they may have self-doubts, but they are men. Manly men. And when people enter their house, they just can kill them really, really, really easily. When Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio kill these people, and I'm not talking about just in self-defense, when they brutally commit acts of really just over-the-top violence against these people, they have no sense of that context. This isn't like the end of Inglourious Basterds, where at the end of World War II, a bunch of Jewish soldiers get to enact their revenge on Hitler. This is pre-venge. This is like Minority Report situation, where these people actually haven't done the thing yet. And that, I think that changes the morality of it, and I also think it completely ignores the reality of what a lot of the people within the Manson family were actually going through. It's not like they were all really happy in a cult and just watching TV all day. A lot of these people were really tortured and brainwashed, and they are, murderers. A lot of them belong in jail, but in a way, they're also kind of victims in and of themselves. And I think the movie completely ignores that reality in order to inject a fan service alternate reality in which fictional characters Tarantino likes get to be lifted up by injecting themselves into a tragedy in which they have absolutely no part. So that, for me, is how that feels differently than a lot of other movies that play around with violence. Even Tarantino's own films. And I like almost all of Tarantino's films. So for me, that's where the line is. But again, I haven't seen Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down. Maybe if I watched it, I would be pissed. I cannot say. And again, I know I'm in the minority opinion on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I know a lot of people love the shit out of it.
You should watch more Almodovar films. That's my comment.
I do know that.
His newest one was one of my favorites of this last year.
My first... Almodovar was one of those filmmakers where my first introduction to their work was not great. And as a result, I wasn't super excited to check out more of his work. But since then, I've seen more of his work, and I've been meaning to catch up because I finally saw All About My Mother not that long ago when we did it on the podcast.
See All About My Mother.
That one for me, I'm like, oh, okay, now I want to see everything he's ever done.
Talk to Her is really good.
That was the one I saw, and I didn't like it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I thought it was...
I like Talk to Her a lot.
I didn't care for it, but whatever. All About My Mother slayed me. I love it.
Be sure to see Pain and Glory, though.
Literally seeing it tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. and I can't comment on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, so...
good, bad, Whitney can't talk about it, and I apologize for that. That sucks.
Yeah.
By the way, I would love to have a more complicated conversation with Whitney.
As a critic, I would love to be able to comment on it, but I'm just in a position where I'm not permitted.
Yeah.
Here's a letter from Lewis. Hello, Lewis.
Hello.
Dear Bibbs and the Wheelman. The Wheelman?
I like it.
Am I like the...
You're like Frank Grillo in that Netflix movie.
I was about to... Am I driving away from the heist scene?
Yeah, sliding away from, I don't know, underwater, whatever movie you just saw at the theater.
Now, before you hurt yourself with your eyes rolling over the Wheelman, I want you to hear me out. I know that in general, remakes are, at the very least, awful and can be reprehensible. However, I don't think they are inherently bad. As long as they are well-acted and interesting, I don't see a problem with the remakes. After all, what is a remake but a new production of an existing story that happens in the theater all the time?
Exactly.
So in that vein, if it were thrust upon you to remake a classic film, what film would you choose, who would you cast in the main roles, and what, if anything, would you change to keep it interesting? By way of example, Sunset Boulevard. In my remake, Norma Desmond is, instead of an aging silent film star, an aging 70s action star, played by Sigourney Weaver. The William Holden role is played by John Boyega. the Max von Sydow role. I think not Max von Sydow.
Otto Preminger.
Who plays the role of Max? Would be played by Werner Herzog.
Yeah, that's good casting.
And instead of Cecil B. DeMille, it's either Ridley Scott or James Cameron.
I like all these things.
Who worked with Sigourney Weaver, so that's all pretty clever. Yeah. The film is pretty much the same as the original, except now it is set now, and Norma wants a limited series written that she plans to star in to sell to Netflix or Amazon instead of a film. Fair.
Yeah.
All of that's fair. That could be fine.
I like it.
So I put it to you. What film would you remake, and who would you cast? And before Whitney says, I don't want remakes, I want something new, it's for fun, man. Relax. Play the game. Thanks for the podcast, Lewis.
Thank you. Well, first off, I there's this weird anti-remake mentality.
Not as much as it was like a couple of years ago.
Yeah, but it's still out there. And you see people talking about, oh, I can't believe they remade, I don't know, Black Christmas or whatever. And I'm like, but they did it before. Like, it's fine. Like, I used to be mad about remakes because, oh, how dare they besmirch the bloody blue. But the older I got, the more remakes I saw, and the more I realized two things. One, a lot of remakes are good. Not necessarily great, but most movies aren't necessarily great. I'll take good. A remake's job isn't necessarily to improve upon the original. It just needs to justify its own existence. So it has its own take. It has its own idea. I'm fine. If it's not as good as the original, fine. We still have the original. I'll live with it, and I'm less offended now that, like, oh, there's another Total Recall out there. I'll mention that there's another Total Recall and get back to talking about the good one. I'm okay with it. So I'm not against remakes. I'm not against them at all. Sometimes I roll my eyes, but usually I'm like, whatever. It'll either be good or it won't.
There is something really obnoxious about the way remakes, however, kind of elbow their way into a conversation. Like, unfortunately, there are now three feature films that are simply called Halloween, all about the same characters. So
that's mildly annoying.
It's annoying that you have to sort of distinguish and you have to sort of work your way around which film you're talking about rather than just sort of having a conversation about a single film. Because the remake, just in being made, whether or not it was good or bad, has now altered the landscape. And
that's true, but is the purity of the landscape really the most important thing?
No, it's just for cleanliness of conversation I'm concerned with.
I remember there were people online who, I don't know if this was an actual suggestion or not, or an actual idea that was floated, but someone online suggested that there might be a possibility that, like, Universal was going to remake Jaws. And a lot of people are like, how dare you besmirch Jaws? And I'm like, what are you talking about? We had three sequels this besmirching Jaws.
Yeah. Have you seen Jaws the Revenge? Yeah, that thing's a piece of crap.
All of them are kind of like, listen, I like two of them. They're stupid, but I like them. They're
incredibly stupid.
Yeah, but there are two Jaws sequels that I very much enjoy watching, even though they're not good movies. They all make Jaws 1 look a little dumber, also, but we still have Jaws 1 and no one cares. It's fine.
They've remade all kinds of classic films. They remade Breathless. They remade Psycho.
Yeah. Oftentimes, people just forget about the remake.
Yeah.
Like, no one talks about that remake of Breathless. Like, nobody talks about it.
Like, Richard Gere completionist, and that's just about it.
which is admittedly a very powerful, group in Hollywood.
It's that one guy. they made a sequel to The Birds, for goodness sake. They're doing this kind of crap all the time to you. It's just not necessarily,
it's not well published. Well, because people forget about the remake of The Birds. People forget about all the made-for-TV remakes of Roman Holiday or Miracle on 34th Street. Why? Because they're forgettable.
And
then they just sort of slip by, and every once in a while, I'll tweet about, like, hey, do you know Arnold Schwarzenegger directed a remake of A Christmas in Connecticut? And people are like, he fucking what? And I'm like, yeah.
More than once, and we watched it together. I have to remind you that they remade Dirty Dancing.
I'm not
talking about Havana Nights. I'm talking about that big, long TV production.
That movie sucks so bad.
It sucks so bad.
It's a bad movie.
Like, we have to remind ourselves about how bad it is, because it's also forgettable.
But to the question, and I think it's a fun question, you're given carte blanche to make a movie. You get the cast you want, you get the budget you want. The rule is it has to be a remake of a classic film.
Okay.
What do you lean towards? What's your take?
Okay.
You can do it.
I want Michel Gondry to take the exact same script that Joss Whedon wrote for The Avengers, and I want him to make it for $10,000.
You want him to Swede the Avengers.
Yeah, I want him to Swede the Avengers. Or Avengers Endgame. And better yet, Avengers Endgame, because that's like 3 hours long. And
do
has like
people remember Sweding? I bet there's a bunch of people listening to us who have no idea what we're talking about.
It was a buzzword for like a year and a half.
There was a movie Michel Gondry made, a comedy starring Jack Black and, was it Mos Def?
It was Mos Def, yeah.
And they played...
It's called Be Kind Rewind.
Be Kind Rewind. Funny movie. I like it a lot. And well, two guys who work at like the last VHS video store, and people will actually come to them for VHS, but there's an accident with a magnet and all the movies are accidentally erased, and in order to keep renting the movies out, they make their own remakes using what they can find around the house
and what they remember of the script.
And so it's actually kind of like they're using pre-existing art to make their own art, and the way that they remake them with through their own like abilities and budget and lens is kind of their own artistic statement. And then the studios come down on them.
For ripping them off.
It's actually kind of an interesting conversation about the way that we repurpose art and the way that we use...
And especially now, the way a lot of people are sort of making healthy livings doing things like cosplay. Like remaking costumes that other people designed.
Or all these like deep fake trailers people are putting online, etc. Like theoretically, you don't own any of that.
Or like you're an artist and you do this landscape, but it's a landscape of like something from Mad Max or Star Wars. And you know, that is another person's creative vision, but you are creating art based on it. So there's some of your artistic talent in there. Yeah, and that's actually a huge part of what's going on with sort of geekery right now. A lot of people are just creating their own art, creating their own world, creating an entire community out of making art based on other people's art.
Yeah.
And I think Michel Gondry was trying to sort of tap into that, and I think he was encouraging creativity, not necessarily slavish devotion to certain kinds of films. But I would love to see an actual sanctioned Swede of some gigantic blockbuster. I just went to the Avengers, but you could. I'd also like to see him do it for like Titanic,
sure,
or just anything that really rattled the zeitgeist.
I would like to. I was looking this up recently. Do you know? And again, with all silent cinema, history is spotty because people weren't keeping clear records because nobody thought this was going to be this huge historical need for an archive. But allegedly. The first movie remake, do you know what it was? Based on all that we have information-wise.
First movie?
It's a famous movie.
Was it Frankenstein?
No.
No, it was probably way before Frankenstein.
The Great Train Robbery.
Well, was it a remake of something else?
No, they remade it a year later.
Oh, no kidding. Okay.
So one of the early, most influential silent films is a film called The Great Train Robbery. It came out in 1903. It was a longer film than many of the silent shorts at the time. And it was about a train robbery. And it was a daring film full of stunts and criminality. And there's a very famous shot of a cowboy with a gun firing into the camera. And it's something that like Scorsese has paid homage to. It's very influential. It's a short film. You should totally check it out. 1 year later, they remade it because why not? That one made money. Let's do another one. It's the exact same thing, but this one's in 1904. I would think as a playful homage to the first remake ever, we should remake The Great Train Robbery. It's been remade before. But we should remake The Great Train Robbery. And this time, I would like to see George Miller directed. George Miller directing a movie about a train robbery in 1903.
There you go.
I think that's a really great idea.
Set in 1903, or is it like Unstoppable or The Runaway Train?
Well, the movie. Okay, well, actually, looking it up right here, the actual train robbery it is allegedly based on, which was Butch Cassidy train robbery.
It's like 1860s.
1900.
1900.
So I would set it in 1900.
Okay,
that's the rule. Set in 1900, it's a historical film, but I want it to feel as breathless as Mad Max Fury Road in its own way. And I think that'd be really cool. And all I want is that everyone in the film has a gorgeous mustache. Mustaches galore. A mustache for you. A mustache. We give out mustaches to the audience. Come the first night, get a mustache.
It's your William Castle gimmick.
Yeah, everyone gets a mustache.
And speaking of William Castle, can we bring back one of those? Can we remake The Tingler?
Yeah, we actually fit like in all of those like 40X theaters or whatever. They get like buzzes for.
No, this time you actually electrocute people.
The point wasn't that they electrocuted you. The point is that you could feel a buzzing,
a vibration,
a tingling. Not actually electrocuting.
Call it
people.
The electric stab. Points throughout the movie, like electrodes stab into your shoulders and give you a shock. Not kill you. Not enough to kill you, but, you know,
I really
straighten your body out a little bit.
I miss Dark Castle.
Dark Castle Studios? They're still around, aren't they?
I know, but I mean, they had like an ethos for a while. If you remember this in the late 90s. Like the
remake of 13 Ghosts.
Yeah, in the late 90s, Robert Zemeckis and a few other people put together a film studio called Dark Castle, and their whole raison d'etre for years was just to remake William Castle movies. And they did three, and they're all pretty good.
I'd say they're all pretty bad.
They're all entertaining, though. Yeah. I think they're really fun. House on Haunted Hill is a real hoot.
House on Haunted Hill is pretty good.
It's very entertaining. It's a bunch of really great campy actors mugging with a bunch of really crazy CG horror effects, and it's a lot of fun. 13 Ghosts is fun. It's not much to it, but I like the monsters. They're all cool. I like it a lot.
Here's something really embarrassing. That remake of 13 Ghosts is one of the few films I've seen in a theater twice in a day.
Why?
Because I was consuming films pretty voraciously at the time, so I just sort of went out in the morning and saw it on my own, forgetting that I had promised a friend that I would see it with them that evening. So I came out, I was like, okay, you ready to see 13 Ghosts? Oh, shit. I gotta see this thing again. If I want to be a good friend, I gotta see this thing again. Okay, I'll see it again.
You know who's good in that movie? Matthew Lillard.
Matthew Lillard's a fan. Matthew Lillard,
there used to be a performance, they might still have it, but there used to be an award at the MTV Movie Awards called the Best Scared as Shit Performance.
Wait, they did House on a Hill, they did 13 Ghosts, what was their third William Castle?
I thought... Am I misremembering this? Did they only do the two to start with and then the kind of peter out?
They did
out?
Stuff like Gothica and Ghost Ship.
Ghost Ship wasn't based on anything? Yeah, you're right. No, I guess they did only do the two. I wish they'd stuck with it, I guess is my point. I would have loved to have seen like...
I just called up their...
Like Jessica Tandy in Straight Jacket or something. Like... How cool would that have been?
A very different film.
Yeah.
I love Jessica Tandy, but she's no Joan Crawford.
I finally saw Straight Jacket. If you've never seen Straight Jacket.
Straight Jacket's awesome.
Holy shit, Straight Jacket is good. Joan Crawford plays a woman who killed her husband. And she's in a mental institution for many years. And then her daughter, who is grown up and is about to get married. Joan Crawford comes out of the mental institution and she's with her daughter. And her daughter's just... Everyone's keeping a special eye on Joan Crawford because it looks like she could snap at any time and kill us all. And... Boy, is it stylish and great. And Joan Crawford gives a really good performance, actually. He will give her a lot of crap for that movie. It's so good.
Dark Castle Entertainment also did the remake of House of Wax. Maybe that's the one you're
thinking. That's probably what I'm thinking.
That wasn't a William Castle film.
But it's a similar vibe. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of.
They also did Splice and Orphan, which are awesome movies.
They did some good shit, man. God, I would love to produce horror movies.
Their last movie was Suburbicon, the George Clooney movie, which nobody remembers.
Also, that's a weird... That doesn't really fit the brand.
Yeah.
Anyway, see Straight Jacket. I promise you, you'll dig Straight Jacket. It's crazy. It's stylish and weird and campy and wonderful.
And any of the William Castle films from the late 50s on are just going to be
But they're not all necessarily good movies. I think Straight Jacket is actually a legitimately good movie.
I'd suppose so.
You know, like it's even some of those lesser broad, films, but
like Homicidal, I Saw What You Did. Yeah. I haven't seen Shanks. The one with Marcel Marceau, but I heard that one's pretty good.
All right. Let's do one last letter and then we'll move on.
All right. This one is from Zay. Hello, Zay.
Hi, Zay.
Hello, Bibbs and Whitney. I've been listening for the past year and a half to your myriad of podcasts and decided to finally write in. I'm writing after the Kazam/Man Who Fell to Earth double feature.
Okay.
From our sadly now defunct podcast, The Two Shot.
But we're replacing it with something neat.
Yep. When you said, don't make this your first foray into art house cinema, when it was mine and my friend's first.
Aww.
It piqued my interest because at the time David Bowie was quickly becoming my idol, and he still is, and I'd already seen Labyrinth, and The Man Who Fell to Earth kept coming up when learning more about him. At the time, the film was available on Netflix, and I decided to dive in and show it to my friends. Best believe no one would let me pick the movie for a while after that.
See what I mean? It's a bit of a deep dive.
Yeah, I'll admit that I didn't even get it at the time, but I found it incredibly exciting at the time, despite my misunderstandings, and I appreciate it a lot more now, further in my film viewing career. My question is, are there any art house films you guys watched way too soon, or films you tried to show your friends and they immediately dismissed it, or made you feel weird for wanting to show you that film? Oh, that's like a third of my life. Thanks for everything you guys do. I'm getting to spend multiple hours of my week with you guys in my ear. All love, Zay.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, no, seriously, like when you get into like the weird stuff. And, like, your friends are not on that journey with you at the same time. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, you'll open someone's eyes, but most of the time, they'll be like, dude, just can we watch Fast Times at Ridgemont High? Like, just some mainstream thing. Like, I've always been a DVD collector once I started, like, having my own money. I just love having a library available. And then people would come over, and, like, especially when I had roommates, like, who weren't, like, my spouse, like, I would just live with people who I knew in college or whatever, and their friends would come over, and they'd be like, oh, you have all these movies. And I'd be like, yeah, what do you want to watch? And they never, like, look at all my interesting, weird stuff. They always said one of three things.
Pirates of the Caribbean.
No.
Oh,
Fight Club.
Reservoir Dogs, yeah, no. Okay.
It was Fight Club.
Uh-huh.
Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Huh.
And Old School, which I didn't even own.
Yeah.
Those are the three. Those are the only films they wanted to watch for, like, all of, like, 2004 through, like, 2008. And then I finally moved out on my own, and I got rid of all that in my life. Yeah. That was gone.
Yeah. But, no, I had an identical experience. Yeah. Like, because I was collecting either, like, new weird art house stuff, some classic cinema that I was just starting to get into at the time.
Yeah.
Or just, like, weird culty stuff. So it's like, what do you want to watch? Dr. Strangelove or Ben-Hur?
Mm-hmm.
Or Begotten? Like, those are your choices.
What is with you and Begotten tonight?
I like Begotten.
I don't.
It's just
you're not supposed to like Begotten. Begotten is a film you're supposed to like see, but if you like it, I feel like you're probably doing it wrong. Begotten is a very weird, fucked up experimental horror film from E. Elias Marige, who also did Shadow of the Vampire, which I would argue is one of the great horror movies of the century so far.
And Begotten too. Well, it's silent. There's no dialogue. It's just sound effects. There's a little bit of music, and it's filmed in this kind of really, I'm not exactly sure how we even filmed it, this kind of chiaroscuro, difficult to see black and white grainy photography.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about, you know, gods destroying themselves and the spawn of the gods quivering on the earth. And yeah, all this really heady artistic theological stuff,
which is a really interesting way to say it's a bunch of weird people in masks in a shack, but okay.
You know what? Weird people in a masks in a shack. That's how a lot of film careers get started.
I'm not going to fight you on that. Mm-hmm. I'm just not the biggest fan of the Begotten, but, yeah, I'm trying to think of, like, times when I completely whiffed it. Like, where I was like, oh, let's watch this thing. And people are like, fuck you.
My friends still came back to me occasionally when I insisted.
Mm.
So when I saw Julie Taymor's Titus...
you'd think that would work, because it's full of incident and craziness, and energetic and violent,
and, you know, just there's cannibalism and all kinds of horrible things in that film. And it's Shakespeare, so there's all this exciting language. And I loved it. I saw it and I just fell in love immediately. And I said, okay, I know you guys never listen to me. I know you hate it whenever I do this, but you guys got to get, forget about Eraserhead. You guys need to come with me now and see Titus. And I actually got them all together and they all bought their tickets and they all saw Titus. One of my friends kind of liked it. Everybody else said, we're not letting you pick anymore. It's too long. It's too weird. What is this crap you're making us watch?
Man, I don't understand not liking Titus, man.
Titus is so exciting.
I understand not loving Titus. I don't understand, like, being bored with Titus. Titus is, like, designed to grab you. Like, just, like, pay attention to me! I'm like, okay, Titus, sorry!
It's Shakespeare's biggest hit.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of times when I've just completely bombed it. Mm. Like, I know I've tried showing people horror movies that they just did not feel, like, at all. Like, I think... I tried showing people Wes Craven's The Hills of Eyes, and they just couldn't get into it. They couldn't take it seriously, which I guess fair enough, but I don't understand it. Yeah, I had a lot of that, like, with, like, some, like, early horror movies where people... I remember... This isn't the same thing, but I remember I was dating someone once, and I found out on Halloween she'd never seen John Carpenter's Halloween. She'd only seen Rob Zombie's Halloween. And I was like, we should see John Carpenter's Halloween. I think it's better. And she preferred Rob Zombie's Halloween.
No accounting for taste. That's,
we broke up a week later. That's all. I'm not going to say that that was the reason, but I'm also not going to say that that wasn't a factor.
All right. When you're young, you do test friends and potential mates with your taste sometimes.
There's a great...
Not the most mature thing to do, but it's something we all do.
There's a great bit in The Big Sick. What does he make her watch in The Big Sick? Is it like Flash Gordon or something?
Oh,
or,
I forgot what it was. Something like that.
Kumail Nanjiani. Some
80s cult movie.
Yeah, it's like he's like... showing her a movie, but he's only looking at her to gauge her reaction. She's like, no, I love being tested.
Yeah. Like she knows what's going on immediately.
Yeah, she's like, no, this, you're not here to see me see the movie. You're here to see if I like the movie the way you like the movie.
Oh, I think it was Dawn of the Dead.
Oh, that makes sense.
Was it Dawn of the Dead? That might have been Dawn of the Dead.
I believe it. It's one of those.
Yeah, it's like, you're really going to like this because this is a good judge of your character. Oh, I love it when my dates test me. She's like...
That's such a good. That should have made my runners up for the best of the decade list. That movie,
the Big Sick, is awesome.
That movie destroyed me. That's so well made. Good, yeah. All right, so that's it for our Let Us Come long one this week. And thank you very much, everyone who sent in your lists, everyone who sent in your questions. We really appreciate it. And we'll be back next week with more. So be sure to email us letters@criticallyacclaimed.net, where we will read your letters on this show.
The letters I've been reading are a combination of things we just got recently, as well as a lot of old letters from like maybe 2 months ago. We're caught up to about 2 months ago.
That's not bad.
So we're
doing
okay.
We get a lot of letters.
We get a lot
of
letters, and we are not going to read every single one. We do skip over a couple, just as a matter of course. We can't get to all of them.
Sometimes they're about similar topics.
Yeah, we're going to skip over. Like, if several people ask us the same question, we'll skip over everybody else's. But that's not meant as a slight to you at all. We appreciate every single letter you get. We read every letter you get.
And as you can tell, we try to take every one of them seriously and talk as much about them as we can. So again, letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Feel free to send us an email. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already to the Critically Acclaimed Network. Leave us a review wherever you find us. That helps us find an audience, which really is awesome. If you want even more of Bibbs and Whitney, by God, there's more.
There's always more.
Patreon.com/criticallyacclaimed network. Mm-hmm. We have a ton of stuff there, including all our yesterdays, our Star Trek podcast, where we review every single episode of Star Trek in production order. We have Only the Best, where we review every single nominee for Best Picture in chronological order. We're behind on our commentary tracks, which we're going to try to crank out soon. Sorry about that. And there's a ton more stuff besides. We're having a Google Hangout in a few days, people at our top tier. A lot of fun stuff. Yeah. Going over there. Oh, and if you're a fan of the movie Trivia Schmodown, and if you live in the New York area, you might want to try to stop by. I will be playing a three-way movie trivia match at the Roulette Theater. I think it's Saturday the 25th. It's the last Saturday in January.
Okay.
Against the great Dan Morrell from Screen Junkies, and also Brendan Meyer, the co-star of The Guest. Which is an odd thing, but that's the way it is. So there's that. And also, we're on Twitter.
We're on Twitter.
At Critic Acclaim. I'm at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibel.
And we want to thank everybody who took the time to write us, everybody in the future, whoever will take the time to write us, and everybody else, because why not? Anyway, sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.